south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
Okay, here's some good news. There's a new podcast by phone feature. My parent station, PRN-FM, up in New York City, the mothership, is offering for those of you who are on the road. So what's that mean? Well, now there's a way for all you listeners to hear my last five podcasts / radio shows by dialing up a phone number or Skyping, whatever phone service you're most comfortable with. All you have to do is dial up this number. 1-701-719-0893. Once again, 1-701-719-0893. And I imagine the first digit 1 is for people living outside the New York area. That would be the long distance code. At least I think it is. Last time I dialed the phone up in the States, it was 27 or 28 years ago. So now you can go to your phone rather than go to the archive or try to download the show from other sources. Now, remember, using the dial-up method, you'll be able to get the last five shows. Again, that's called the podcast by phone service. For people on the run, sounds great. Anyway, you know, the last couple of shows I've been talking a bit about health insurance and healthcare, first world style, here in Latin America. Always an extremely popular subject with the over 40 crowd, I might add. Now, to piggyback on that a bit, if what I'm going to tell you now doesn't get you off the fence, if you are a fence sitter, still thinking you could hunker down in the States somewhere when the shite hits the ventilator, and by the way, I'd lay odds that it does right after the election. Anyway, after what I'm going to tell you now, if you don't think you ought to get that plan B going full speed ahead, well, you'll be better off just sitting on the sofa, grabbing a bag of Cheetos and the remote, and watching a few episodes of Botched. Oh, and by the way, Botched is pretty popular down here in Latin America. It's translated on E! Entertainment, Latin America, but it's not called Botched. It's called Botched. Laughed like crazy when I first heard a Latin person say, "Johnny, have you seen that new show, Botched?" Yep, once again, lost in translation. Speaking of lost in translation, you really have to look out for Google Translate. Believe me, you can get yourself in a lot of trouble using that. Anyway, I want you to listen right now to a couple of snippets from this article. Starts by saying, Monsanto puppets in the U.S. Senate announced a compromise to outlaw GMO labeling laws nationwide. Then it says, while U.K. citizens were revolting in mass voting for Brexit, another cabal of prostitute lawmakers were plotting against American food consumers. According to a U.S. Commission on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry, lawmakers have come up with a compromise agriculture biotech solution. So, what is this so-called compromise? Compromise on what? It decrees that for 2 years there'll be no GMO labeling of foods in the U.S. Meanwhile, as the FDA ponders the best way to deceive consumers and hide Monsanto's GMOs for another few years, the proposed law gives the U.S. FDA the right to declare any foods with less than 50% bioengineered content, that's GMO, to be considered non-GMO for labeling purposes. And as a bonus surrender to Monsanto, the law would not require animal products derived from GMO-fed animals to be considered bioengineered at all, allowing cattle feedlots to pump cows and other animals full of GMOs and glyphosates, the resulting meat and meat products being considered all natural. Then finally, after 2 years, the FDA would require food companies to roll out a QC barcode. Then consumers would have to use a smartphone to scan those codes, and that would be the only way the consumer would know which foods the FDA says have GMOs. So according to the proposed law, there need only be a scannable barcode. In other words, no longer will GMO labeling have to be in actual symbols, letters, numbers, or words. This is how the food industry can claim they have agreed to label GMO products without actually labeling GMOs. So that's the state of subterfuge between Monsanto and your scumbag sociopathic politicians, who, by the way, you voted in. So bottom line, a QR code is unreadable by humans. It must be scanned. So the U.S. Senate is rolling out a GMO labeling law that basically states they don't want you to read the ingredient labels with the human eye. So the legislative prostitutes for Monsanto are at it again. And yes, in the end, they will win. So you must get off the fence and get that Plan B going. I mean, really, what are you waiting for? Then it goes on to say, if you look at the aging congressmen and senators who are pushing such laws, you'll see most of these individuals even look like they've been poisoning themselves with age and wrinkle accelerating chemicals. In other words, none of them with any real scientific knowledge of what kind of damage chemicals, pesticides, glyphosates, etc. can do to humans and animals. Then, the author says, like I've repeatedly advised natural news readers, Republicans, as a rule, are scientifically illiterate and Democrats economically illiterate. Politicians are all, he says, cognitively retarded on certain subjects. And so, in the end, we're all having toxic poisons shoved down our throats while the political establishment ridiculously claims they are fulfilling their duties by mandating labeling, even though they can only be read by computer scanning devices. Then finally, he says, doesn't this make you just a little bit angry? What is it going to take for the American public to get pissed off? Well, they're not, but the smart ones will vote with their feet. Now, won't they? I added the last part, by the way. So I'll ask you again, how's that Plan B coming? By the way, if you want to know who's running this Monsanto-driven GMO cover-up crap, it's Pat Roberts, Republican of Kansas, and Debbie Stabenow, Democrat of Michigan. Hey, these are your scumbag dickheads. You voted them in. Now it's time you vote with your feet because you cannot change that system. It's too corrupt, too malignant. It's over with. And if you can't see that now, well, like I said, grab that bag of Cheetos and that remote control and start surfing. By the way, this bill's called the Dark Act GMO Labeling Compromise Bill. Sounds so trite and innocuous, doesn't it? That's what they want you to think, anyway. It's just a biotech Monsanto scam designed to stealthily outlaw GMO labeling. You can see the whole breakdown and write-up of that on Mike Adams Natural News. Oh, and one thing about politicians, expat Eddie, who's always good for a quip, he says when they get reelected, it's just a case of the criminal returning to the scene of the crime. Can't argue with that. Oh, and speaking of expat Eddie, here are some more words of wisdom I heard from him the other day. We were talking about how real old-school musicians, people that actually play real musical instruments, they consider rap, hip-hop, and DJing a lesser art form. Even to call it an art form is being kind. Kind of like the difference between a Gauguin or a Picasso and a kid bringing home a crayon stick drawing from sixth grade art class. Anyway, Eddie and I were saying to real musicians, the only so-called music that's even more grating than hip-hop and rap is that awful reggaeton music, which is, by the way, the oh-so-popular bad Latin Spanish language copy of rap and hip-hop, if that's possible, and it is. Anyway, as Eddie puts it, bad music is like B.O. You notice it, but the purveyor never does. So down here, you'll hear that awful reggaeton music all the time, so you'll have to flip a switch in your head and try to turn it off, like you try to do at the dentist or a bad karaoke performance. Otherwise, it's a miserable experience. Like I said to Pasho, call me old-fashioned, call me a prude, call me a stick in a mud, but I like a song with a beginning, a middle, and an end. One that has words that occasionally rhyme, a song that has more than five words that keep repeating over and over again, and maybe one or two multi-syllable words to break the monotony. One with themes other than hoes, guns, bling, drugs, money, sex, and shooting people. A song that can actually be sung, where a guy's hands aren't spastically bobbing up and down and his fingers poking imaginary holes everywhere. Now, is that too much to ask? Music used to be like that, you know. But you see, I'm kind of prejudiced. I started playing cello in second grade. Along the way, learned to play about five or six more real instruments. I actually played as a sideman for a few famous groups you might have heard of from the 70s and 80s. So I have some skin in the game. And, miracle of miracles, I can actually read music, or I used to be able to read music. So when guys like me make the comment that rap, hip-hop, and reggaeton are the GMOs of the music business, contributing greatly to the corporate dumbing down of the music industry, sound familiar? Sadly, I can present a pretty convincing case. But I digress as usual. Man, did I digress. Anyway, for a minute, I want to refer back to a show I did last week when I was talking about using anonymous mail services like StartMail, etc. I'm sure you'll like this, just reading this from PC Magazine recently. You ever read that magazine? It's kind of geeky. Well, you know, to each his own. Anyway, it says, a Microsoft sales department study notes that the intrinsic value of each first world person's personal data is worth $1,250 in today's marketplace. So think about that every time you give up your name, address, or email address in a pop-up box trying to get free stuff. It ain't free. All of internet marketing and sales is based on data mining. Why? Because it's got that value. So like it or not, that's what all internet users are caught up in. Don't think that any of those free services out there are benevolent. They're not. Oh, and by the way, Microsoft also put a value on the dats and personal data of third world people. That would be people from India, China, Indonesia, Latin America. They put that value at $300 in today's market. That said, as you formulate your plan B and come down to Latin America or elsewhere in the third world, it will probably be the first and last time in your life you're able to gain back a substantial chunk of your anonymity and significantly lower your internet and social media footprint. Do keep that in mind as you prepare your plan B. That said, here's something I'm sure you didn't know. When you sign up for Facebook, you automatically give them permission to turn on and record from your computer or cell phone camera. Go ahead, check out the terms of the agreement, which no one ever reads, and you'll see that it's true. So my advice, leave your phone in another room on date night and when nature calls. Of course, you could always drop your drawers and moon Zuckerberg. That'd be cool. Maybe we could even pick a day and have all 3 billion people on Facebook moon him at the same time. I can think of no one else that deserves it more. Can you? And now, on to an expat topic that's really hot these days. Renunciation of American citizenship. You know, just a few years back, no one ever spoke of renouncing. But lately, I've been getting plenty of emails about it. That said, today I'd like to read you some excerpts of one American's journey into the never-never land of citizenship renunciation. By the way, if you consider doing it, you'll have to have another citizenship, a passport from another country, or you'll be a stateless person, an illegal alien. But you knew that already, right? Anyway, I'd like to thank Jack Brett, the author of that famous little ebook, Fast Spanish, that so many people have been asking me about. By the way, Jack's an alumnus from one of my Expat Insider seminars. He forwarded this true story to me. The article's aptly titled, Unbecoming American, One Man's Painful Journey to Renouncing Citizenship. And I'll paraphrase a bit here. It starts out, I am an American. And in April 2012, I returned to Switzerland, which is the country of my birth, to commence a new phase of my adult life. Naturally, one of the first steps to undertake when establishing oneself in a new country is to open a bank account. So I went down to the local Raiffeisen Bank branch in the village of Eschick, Lucerne, Switzerland, where my relatives and ancestors have lived and worked as farmers for over 10 generations. At the bank, I received the standard application forms required to open a basic checking account. The form asked me about my nationality. I marked Swiss as my nationality and the United States as my second nationality. The clerk reviewed the forms and said, I'm sorry, we can't open a bank account for you because you are a U.S. citizen. I said, but I'm a Swiss citizen. I know, she said, but you have U.S. nationality too. And earlier this month, we received a directive from top management not to open any more accounts for U.S. passport holders, even if they are also Swiss. So I left the bank angry and confused. I checked with other banks, several other banks. It was the same story with all of them. I told the story to my Swiss relatives. They all had the same reaction. But you're Swiss. At that time, I was completely ignorant of the FATCA laws, the global taxation of U.S. citizens, the requirement to report foreign bank account balances over $10,000 U.S. to the Treasury Department via the FBAR paperwork when you do your taxes. Back then in 2012, I knew nothing of all these compliance matters that, at least amongst U.S. expats, have become hot-button topics in recent years. As for my story, I left the U.S. at the age of 22 after university. Never having really worked in the States beyond part-time student jobs, and in fact had been living in Japan and Taiwan for the previous 7 years teaching English before moving to Switzerland. It's not as though the U.S. government gives you an exit interview when you leave the country, explaining to you how to comply with all their cumbersome laws just because you're outside the States. The burden is on you, the taxpayer, to inform yourself or face heavy penalties, up to $10,000 each year of noncompliance. Nope, they don't tell you that stuff, but you are guilty until proven innocent. Suddenly, I realized I had technically been noncompliant with the U.S. laws for years, although I never made much money at all. I was furious. What right did the U.S. government have to try to tax me or make me declare anything to them, not having actually lived there for almost 10 years? No other developed country in the world requires this. I didn't make enough money to actually have to pay U.S. tax. Not only that, you know you can exclude more than $100,000 of foreign earned income each year if you live out of the United States most of the year. All right, let's stop for a second. This is me, Johnny, butting in again. He says no other developed country in the world requires its citizens to report their foreign income and get taxed on it. He was right about that until this year. Now, as you know, if you've been listening to this show for any length of time, Colombia, Brazil, and Argentina have jumped on that bandwagon. So do remember that if any of those countries are in your plan B. So let's continue. He says, the very principle of having to comply with all this crap enraged me. That's when I first considered renouncing my U.S. citizenship. So I contacted the U.S. Embassy in Bern, Switzerland, who quickly sent me an informational package. All I had to do was backfile 5 years of tax returns. I could exclude all my earnings from U.S. taxation, make an appointment at the U.S. Embassy in Bern, Switzerland, and pay a $450 administration fee. As I was already a citizen of Switzerland at birth, I wouldn't have to pay an exit tax. It only took 2 to 3 weeks to receive an appointment. It seemed quick and easy. However, I hesitated. That was back in 2012. Yes, I hesitated. I thought about my mother. She still lived in the U.S. What if she got sick or something? What if Switzerland or Europe becomes a terrible place to live in the future? What if the EU breaks up? What if hordes of Muslim immigrants and jihadis invaded a place? That was me, Johnny, who threw that last one in about the Muslims. Anyway, he goes on to say, I thought it might be wise at that time to still keep my U.S. citizenship, just in case. A second nationality, you know, is like an insurance policy against economic and social decline. But what should I do exactly? Should I go through the rest of my life outside the U.S., lying about being a U.S. citizen and saying I was just a Swiss person? Would have been dead easy to open a bank account that way. I found out I'd been non-compliant for years already and had never heard a thing from U.S. authorities. Maybe I could just continue under the radar forever. Or should I just swallow my dignity and comply with U.S. tax rules? I only had to file a simple tax return in the FBAR form. As mentioned, I made too little money to tax anyway. But then, how does this concern my wife? What happens when we have children and I die? Wouldn't they have to pay the U.S. inheritance tax on everything I own? What would be the point of keeping my U.S. citizenship if I didn't plan on passing that citizenship onto my kids? I went back and forth like this in my mind for a couple of years. I couldn't make a decision. I didn't want to lie for the rest of my life, but neither did I want to comply with those ridiculous tax laws. Then, in September 2014, came the tipping point for me. The U.S. State Department raised the administration fee for renouncing your citizenship by 522%, from $450 back in 2012 to $2,350. I realized then I was dealing with a criminal institution. The U.S. was the mafia. Either pay protection money your whole life or pay one lump sum to get out. In the end, what was preventing them from deciding to raise the fee to $5,000 or even $10,000 in the future? Nothing prevents them. There had been record numbers of renunciations over the past few years. It was good business for the U.S. It's not like there existed a powerful expat lobby in Washington pressuring them to change their policies on renunciation. Then, rage took hold of me again. I was so angry at myself for hesitating back in 2012 on my first instinct that my hesitation cost me at least $2,000. However, I let my rage stew for a few months more. I researched the various forms of relinquishment to see if I could find a way out of paying the fee. Turns out, renunciation is just one type of relinquishment, I found out, and certain types of relinquishments do not require you to pay the fee. However, I wasn't ready to pledge allegiance to another religion or Al-Qaeda, and none of the other situations or criteria applied to me. So I finally bit the bullet and made an appointment to renounce. My appointment was set at the embassy in Bern, Switzerland for February 20th, 2015. I've been told by the embassy beforehand that it generally took 2 to 3 months to process the Certificate of Loss of Nationality, called a CLN, the document which officially states you are no longer a U.S. citizen. A few days before my appointment, I went to a networking event where I spoke with two insurance professionals who served foreign clients. They both related stories to me of U.S. citizens in Switzerland who renounced their citizenship. For one client, it took the government over a year to process that CLN document. The other client had renounced 18 months earlier and still hadn't received his CLN. What the hell was going on, I thought. Then, February 20th finally arrived and my appointment was at 3 o'clock, so I took the afternoon off work and headed to Bern. I went to the embassy about 15 minutes before my appointment. There were several U.S. flags flying outside and I felt no emotion when I looked at them. The entrance was guarded by some kind of African military guy wearing a bulletproof vest. He opened the door after I rang a bell. I had my laptop with me. He gestured towards it. He said, "No laptops allowed in here." I looked around. There was nowhere to put it. "So what do I do then?" I said to him. He said, "Go see the lady outside by the security box." I asked her. She told me in Swiss German there was a police station a few blocks away where I could leave it. Like I needed this crap. Once back at the embassy, I went through the metal detector, checked my phone with the security. They directed me downstairs, and I walked towards a female security guard who greeted me. She said, "Take off your sunglasses." I said, "They're not sunglasses. They're regular prescription glasses." "What do you need them for?" she said. "To move through space," I informed her. "Well," she said, "we don't allow sunglasses in here, so take them off till you reach the seating area." I took them off and used sonar to find the seat, then put my glasses back on. Once I regained my vision, I saw there were three other people with me who were going to renounce, all with expressions of resignation on their faces, I might add. I was feeling too somber and involved to chit-chat. I sat silently. While I was there, I eavesdropped on a lady who was talking with one of the people who was going to renounce. She had also brought a laptop and, in course of conversation, said the bakery across the street let her store her laptop there for 3 Swiss francs. I thought, what kind of an embassy is this, running a cash for laptop storage scam? This stuff happens at the embassy of the leader of the free world? So I waited about 5 minutes, went to a window to answer a few basic questions, and they give you a pay slip. Then you take it to another window and pay the $2,350. So I took my receipt back with me to the waiting area. While I was there, I watched and heard two other people going through the entire renunciation process, which takes 5 minutes. When it was my turn, I recited the oath of renunciation and signed a piece of paper. Handed over my U.S. passport, which he punched holes in, invalidating it. The consul then informed me it would take 3 to 5 months before I received that slip of paper, the CLN. It would be mailed from Washington to the embassy in Bern, Switzerland, and they would contact me when it came. He asked me if I had any plans to go to the U.S. during that time. I said no. He then explained that until I received that paper, I would not yet be officially non-American and could travel as a U.S. citizen. However, to enter the U.S. or any other country, you need a passport. Mine was no longer valid. It had holes punched in it. That meant I'd be barred from entering any other country, including the States, unless I had a very good reason, like a funeral. I guess, but maybe not. Unless I could document it with a death certificate. Maybe. Okay, flash forward. 6 months later, August 2015. I had not heard a thing from Bern, Switzerland, or the consulate. I called the U.S. consulate. And I found out they only take calls during a 2-hour window each day. Once I got through a call and identified myself and told them of my case, explaining they said it would take from 3 to 5 months and now it was 6 or more, the consulate guy said, "Yeah, it's been taking longer lately due to IT issues. And your paperwork is hung up in Washington. We have to wait." Flash forward to October. I phoned up again. "Same thing," said the guy at the other end. "IT issues in Washington." Christmas and New Year's came and went, and it was now 1 year. I decided to call a friend of mine who worked at the State Department, a guy I'd known in the Peace Corps. He found out my case was done and resolved in April 2015, just 3 months after I renounced. Sure enough, a week later, after my friend's inquiry, I finally received my certificate of loss of nationality. After 8 months of pointless waiting, since it was already done and processed. So, as for my final thoughts, especially after the delays and experience I've heard from others who've tried the same thing, it makes you want to believe they intentionally delay finalizing renunciation as a form of administrative punishment for doing so. They know you're in a kind of a limbo and can't visit the U.S. during that time. Could it be a final, spiteful, parting middle finger in your face from the U.S. government? Looks to be. As for me, in the end, I needed to actually use government contacts and pull administrative strings to receive the service for which I paid so generously. That said, the experience didn't do much to diminish the impression I had of dealing with a banana republic rather than the greatest superpower the world has ever known. So, in the end, I am truly grateful. I consider myself quite lucky to have been able to accomplish this at all. I'm grateful, though, to have been citizen of birth of one of the most prosperous, most developed democratic societies in the world, Switzerland. Without Swiss citizenship, renouncing would have been much more difficult. Along with that, I'm grateful I did not have any assets or money when I renounced, which would have made the compliance much more difficult. In my case, except for the couple of grand at the beginning, it was virtually costless. I'm also grateful that I was not subject to an exit tax. For those who are, upon renunciation, the IRS taxes you as if you had sold all of your assets right now at one time. Then they make you pay tax as if it was income the moment you renounce. And last but not least, I'm grateful I do not have to vote in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. And just a sidebar to that, another guy writes, I unloaded my USA slave status when it was $450 and have a very similar story to tell. I'm not free by any means, but at least I only have one slave master now. That second passport nationality flag I was lucky to get, and that everyone should get now while they still can. Then he says, this is the weirdest part of my story. I went to the trouble of getting $450 in U.S. Federal Reserve notes to pay the U.S. Embassy. They refused to take my cash. I said, but these are U.S. dollars, green pieces of paper with a statement for all debts, public and private. Printed right there in English. However, they still would not take my Federal Reserve notes, but they did take Visa and MasterCard. Shows you who's in charge, huh? Okay, wow. If that doesn't get you kick-started on your Plan B, I don't know what will. Speaking of Plan B, I've got a few spots left for my January 2017 Expat Insider Seminar. And you know, it's one of the best ways to get your own Plan B jump-started and on the fast track. Just go to www.thenewexpat.com, click on Johnny's 2017 seminar link at the top of the page. Do check it out. And while you're there, for even more knowledge and extra boots on the ground, be sure to have a look at John Galt's pre and post seminar trips. And finally, do check out my YouTube site. That's YouTube/TheExpatFiles. Have some fun and laughs with the pictures and slides that go along with the show. Do subscribe. It's free.
South of the border.
This is the Expat Files, living in Latin America. If you want me to help you out with your own Plan B, just schedule a one-on-one consult. Send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to learn how to move forward with your own Plan B from right up there in the States, go to www.expatplanb.com and check out my three videos. See ya. Nos vemos.